The Gospel of Matthew is, of course, as we have seen, a presentation of Jesus Christ as the King. Matthew is writing from that perspective. Jesus as King. And so in chapters 1 through 10, as we have seen thus far, we see a revealing of the King. His person, his precepts, his prophet, his power, all of those revelations concerning Jesus Christ are seen in chapters 1 through 10, a revealing of the King. Then in chapters 11, 12, and 13, we have seen a rebelling against the King. Rebelling against his person, against his power, against his precepts, against his prophet. And then in chapter 14, to bring us up to date, we enter into a new section from chapters 14 through 20, a retreating with the King. The King now retreats away from the people that are rebelling against him, and he pulls his disciples away into times of real, deep discipleship. He will still have encounters with his enemies, and from time to time the crowds will still surround him. But mainly the thrust of this section of the Bible, of the story of Matthew, is dealing with his retreating or withdrawing with his disciples. Then, in chapter 16, the Pharisees, also with the Sadducees, came. And tempting him, desired him that he would show them a sign from heaven. The Pharisees and Sadducees tracked Jesus down as he was withdrawing or retreating into Galilee, that northern area of Israel. They came to tempt him or to test him, asking him for a sign. This absolutely blows my mind. Here in the previous chapter, we saw that Jesus had just fed 5,000 men with a few loaves and fishes. And then in the sequel, Loaves and Fishes Part 2, he feeds 4,000. I mean, miracles are happening. Signs are flowing. But these Pharisees and Sadducees come and say, "Now show us a sign." It shows exactly what Jesus said in the previous chapter, that these were blind men leading the blind. They were not seeing what was happening right around them. And there is none so blind as those who will not see. They're blind. It's obvious what is happening around them. Miracles and manifestations of the Lord's power and authority, and yet they don't see it. Blind. The Scriptures declare that there comes a point when if a person does not want to see, he will not be able to see. That is a very serious problem. A person refusing to see will soon lose the ability to see. He cannot see. Paul says in 2 Corinthians that Satan has blinded the minds of those who have willingly rejected the gospel. Now they cannot see. A real tragedy. But if a person wants to see, I'm convinced if a person desires to see the light, to know the truth, that no matter what, it will be revealed to them. No matter where they live or where they're at or when they were alive in history, they'll have the opportunity for salvation. I was reading about a woman who went on to become quite an effective Bible teacher about 50 years ago. She was born blind. And she didn't really have a knowledge of Jesus personally. She knew that she wanted to know God. One day, somebody gave to her in Braille a copy of the Gospel of Mark. And she was so drawn to it and so blessed by the story of Jesus that she read it over and over until her fingertips became so calloused that she lost sensitivity. And so this lady then took a knife and began to peel away the skin so her fingers would be sensitized again. And with bloody fingertips, she went over and she would read the story of Jesus. Only Mark's Gospel, that's all that she had in Braille there in France at that time. And she read it and read it and read it. But as she continued to do that, to cut away the skin and the calluses, she damaged her nerve endings so badly that soon she lost all feeling in her fingertips. She was devastated. None of her family nor friends were believers, and they weren't interested in reading to her. Really, she felt like she lost her only part of the Bible that she had available to her, and she felt like she was really losing something precious when she realized her fingertips were no longer sensitive at all, permanently damaged. So she took that gospel for the last time, or so she thought, and she kissed it goodbye, realizing she couldn't read it with her fingertips any longer. And as she kissed that open gospel, she discovered that she was even more sensitive in her lips than she was with her fingertips. So she continued to read the gospel with her lips year after year after year. I thought, how precious, man. Here is a woman who's in love with Jesus Christ, and she ends up reading the gospel with her lips, and she becomes a student, a profound teacher of the Gospel of Mark, because she was kissing the scriptures. You see, those who are blind, who want to see, will see, no matter what the obstacle might be. They might live in some nethermost part of the world. They might have all kinds of obstacles. But those who want to see, who love God, will be able to see. Whereas those who don't wish to see, Pharisees and scribes and Sadducees, even though miracles are happening round about them, they will not see because they don't want to see. Do you see? So these guys come and they say, show us a sign. Right after Jesus had finished feeding the 5,000 and the 4,000. And Jesus then answered and said, when it is evening, you say it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, it will be foul weather today, for the sky is red and lowering. Oh, ye hypocrites! You can discern the face of the sky, but you cannot discern the signs of the times. You've learned to look at the sky and predict what the next day's weather will be, like that little ditty that we have, red at night, sailor's delight, red in the morning, sailors take warning. And Jesus is saying, you've learned to read the sky. Now, why did he use this analogy? You've learned to read the sky, but you're not discerning the times that you live in. Well, there's an interesting reason. The rabbis, some, taught in Jesus' day that a demon could come on the scene and do miracles, earthly miracles, miracles that related to substances on the earth. But only God could do miracles as it relates to the sky. So when these Pharisees and Sadducees come on the scene and say, show us a sign, verse 1, from heaven, it shows that they have bought into this rap that the rabbis were teaching. Well, okay, so you did these miracles, feeding 5,000 and touching the lepers and walking on water or what have you, but you might be a demon. So show us a sign from heaven. And now Jesus uses this analogy. He says, hey, look up into the sky. You can predict the weather if you're into astronomy and into heavenly signs if you're buying into that teaching. But you're not even discerning the signs of the time. Again, the implication here is this. Your own prophet Daniel spoke specifically the time when Messiah would be coming. Daniel chapter 9 prophesied precisely when Messiah would be on the scene. And Jesus is saying, don't you, can't you discern the signs of the times? Don't you know Bible prophecy? If they were studying Daniel chapter 9 like they should have been, they would have known that it was the exact time for Messiah to appear. But they weren't. Jesus indicts them for not knowing prophecy, not discerning the sign of the times. Then he says to them, "A wicked and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and there shall no sign be given unto it." You're not seeing what's happening because you don't want to be seeing. You're finding loopholes in your rabbinical teaching about signs from heaven. And I say to you, you're not reading the signs of the times. No sign will be given to you. You know why? Because signs never convert a person. Miracles never convert a person. They can satisfy a person's curiosity. But they will never bring him into a born-again salvation experience that will lead them into eternity. Signs and wonders can confirm the Scripture, but they cannot and will not convert the sinner. Voltaire, the famous French infidel, who was so bitter against Christianity, so dogmatic against the gospel, said, "Even if a miracle should be wrought in the open marketplace before 1,000 sober witnesses, I would rather mistrust my senses than admit a miracle took place." That's the mentality of the skeptic, of the sinner, of the non-believer. What happened to Voltaire? He was the guy, by the way, who said, 100 years after my death, there will not be a single Bible be found in all of Europe. It was his house that the European Bible Society bought after his death, and it still to this day is the headquarters for distributing and publishing Bibles for Europe. I love it. But as Voltaire laid on his deathbed, this man who said, "I don't care if I saw a miracle, I would doubt my senses more than admit a miracle." He called all of his friends together. And they came around his bed, his students, his protégés, his disciples. And he looked at them as he lay on his deathbed and said, "Be gone, be gone. You have brought me to this damnable place." And he cursed them and threw them out. And as they were leaving the room, as he was dying, his final words were, "It is dark, 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 nothing but darkness." And he died. That's what atheism has to offer. Pleasant. Cursing your friends, crying out for darkness, because the blind, those who will not see, will be cast into outer darkness where they cannot see. It's their choice. And Jesus here is saying it's a wicked and adulterous generation that is caught up looking for signs. If I could see it or believe it, we so often hear. The Bible teaches if you believe it, then you'll see it. That's the way of faith. No sign, except, he said in verse 4, the sign of the prophet Jonah. We've talked about that previously. Jonah, the one who was thrown overboard in the sea, swallowed by a great fish. For 3 days, seemingly in hell itself until he was barfed out on the beach, a symbol of resurrection when he appeared yet again. Jesus said, that's the one sign. Jonah, destroy this temple, he declared, and in 3 days I'll rise again from the dead. That's the issue, gang. That's the argument. My daughter Jessie saw a TV talk show yesterday, and she said, as she was there watching this with some people, that there were 4 or 5 people on this talk show that were all claiming to be Jesus Christ, all claiming to be Messiah. And so she came back and was telling me about how crazy this discussion was between this, like, Geraldo or whatever it was, this talk show and all these people claiming to be Messiah. How do we know? Maybe they are, you might say. Maybe one is. One sign, the sign of Jonah. One sign, resurrection. If any of those guys die and resurrect themselves from the dead, I'll listen to what they have to say. But I care not what their philosophy is or what their powers appear to be. One sign. The resurrection from the dead, that's what validates and vindicates Jesus Christ. That's the whole issue. The resurrection. If Jesus did not rise from the dead, we're all just conjecturing and speculating at best. But Jesus rose again. That's why Easter is so essential. He verified and validated his claims by his resurrection. Jesus said, one sign I'll give you, the sign of Jonah the prophet. And he left them and then departed. And when his disciples were come to the other side, they had forgotten to take bread. And Jesus said to them, take heed, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees. And they reasoned among themselves, saying, it is because we have brought no bread. As they were traveling, Jesus was talking. Having this encounter with the Pharisees and the Sadducees, their blindness, their stupidity in not believing, wanting more and more signs, because signs, as I said, are not converting, they're only addicting. Got to see more. Want more proof. Destroying faith, not fostering it. Jesus said, take heed, man, watch out for this leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And they said, ooh, leaven. It must be that, ooh, he's telling us that we forgot to bring the bread. Hey, Peter, did you bring the bread? No. James, how about, no. Judas, did you, no. Oh, ooh. And they're all there just, you know, moaning and groaning. Who brought the victuals? Who brought the biscuits? Nobody. Oh, no. How ironic. I mean, here Jesus just fed thousands miraculously, and they're worried, oh no, we don't have a loaf of bread with us. They, you see, were so geared towards the material, as we so often can be. They thought Jesus was speaking in material terms about material things, the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. We think so much about the material. I read this a couple of days ago. It shocked me. The average American in 1 year will eat 1.5 tons of food. Steve Hopkins eats 7. One and a half tons of food. We are so thinking about the material and the physical all the time. And so when Jesus would often talk in spiritual and eternal terms, people couldn't relate to it. They were confused by it. Jesus said to Nicodemus in John 3, you must be born again. Oh. Well, how does a man enter into his mother's womb the second time? Jesus was talking spiritually. Nicodemus was trying to figure it out materially. At the woman, or with the woman at the well there in John 4, Jesus said, I have water to give you, which if you drink, you shall never thirst again. Living water. Well, give me this water, she said, so I won't have to come here and keep drawing out of the well. She was again thinking materially, where Jesus was talking about the water of the Spirit internally. Unless you eat of my body and drink of my blood, you can have no part of me, Jesus said in John chapter 6. And what happened? The crowds began to turn away from him. They thought he was talking cannibalism. But again, he was talking not materially, but spiritually. I believe that Jesus is always desiring and trying to get us out of this material, physical thing that we're so caught up in and preoccupied with, and trying to get us into the eternal spiritual mindset. But like these disciples, so often we get so hung up in the material. Even in our spiritual walk, blessings are oftentimes enumerated in physical, material terms. Miracles, physical, material manifestations. We're so hung up in the material. And guess what? This ain't going to last, the material. This is not reality. This is temporary. The clothes that we have, the cars that we drive, the homes that we build, it's all going to burn. It's all going to be out of here. It's the spiritual that is eternal. That's why church is important to me. Because as I come here and meet with you and sing songs of praise and study the Word, I go, oh yeah, that's right. That's right. It's eternity that matters. Not the physical, not the material. Because people are telling you all day long in every advertisement in the newspaper, on television, or over the radio, man, you got to be material. If you really want to be happy, I saw a commercial, it's running on TV now. These people are singing a song of praise to their Toyota. I love my Toyota. I just love it. I just love it. And I go, I can't believe this. I mean, that's where we have sunk to, worshiping Toyotas. And yet, this is what's being pumped at us all the time. I just love it. And ooh, yeah, my Toyota. I mean, everybody knows the answer is Volkswagens. Our society has been so sucked into, and so too here with these disciples. Oh, he must be talking about bread. Jesus said, oh, ye of little faith, why reason ye, verse 8, among yourselves because you have brought no bread? Do you not understand nor remember the 5 loaves and the 5,000? How many baskets took ye up? Neither the 7 loaves of the 4,000, and how many baskets took you up? How is it that you do not understand that I speak it not to you concerning bread, but that you should beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees? Oh, I'm not talking material. That's no problem for me. Jesus here is saying the leaven spiritually. What is leaven? It starts small and spreads through the loaf. It's hidden in the loaf and begins to work its way outwardly through the loaf, causing a swelling up. The leaven of the Pharisees is legalism. Watch out for legalism, where you start putting trips and rules and regulations on yourself or on each other. It starts small, with good intentions perhaps. The book of Galatians is a warning against the leaven of legalism. The Pharisees went around keeping all of their rules and regulations, but their heart was not right with the Lord. The leaven of the Sadducees is not legalism, but liberalism. The Sadducees were not those that were trying to keep each and every law. They were liberal. They said, hey, there are no miracles, there are no angels, there is no resurrection. Really, this whole thing is just to sort of help you be a better person. And the Sadducees, by the way, were the wealthy aristocratic class. The Pharisees were more of your working class men. The Sadducees were your wealthy, educated, snobbish. They were the chief priests and the high priest, always came from the Sadducean party. And that's why they were sad, you see, as we've said before. They didn't believe in miracles. They didn't believe in heaven. They didn't believe in resurrection. They didn't believe in angels. Just like, you see, so often the liberal theology that's prevalent today in our so-called higher educational seminaries, discounting the Bible, discounting the miracle. Beware of it. Beware of legalism. Beware of liberalism. Colossians deals with the subject of liberalism, by the way, for you students. Galatians deals with legalism. Colossians deals with liberalism. Paul says, let no man spoil you through the vain philosophies of this world. Don't let anyone spoil you with education and theories. Well, who really wrote the books of Moses? Moses didn't, of course. That's archaic. That's naive. And they have all their theories about who wrote the books of Moses and how many Isaiahs there were. And these miracles were simply stories to sort of draw a point, but not really happening historically. And this committee gets together once a year who are trying to discover the historical Jesus. And they are telling us now each year which words of Jesus were really spoken by Jesus. And each year they take more words away. And so if they go at their present rate, in 20 years we'll be down to zero. There is no Jesus. They just keep destroying the scriptures. Beware of that kind of puffy, vain, philosophical, pseudo-intellectual liberalism. Watch out for it. Beware of it. Well then, verse 13. Jesus came into the coasts or the borders of Caesarea Philippi, that beautiful area we talked about on Sunday. 25 miles north approximately of Galilee. Beautiful spot. The Jordan River begins there. And he took his disciples there and said, who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? For you students of Scripture, again, Jesus oftentimes, in fact over 80 times, refers to himself as the Son of Man. It speaks of his relatability. He relates to people. He desires to be numbered among us. He relates to us. But also, not only humility, but also prophetically, in Daniel chapter 7, verse 13, Messiah, the promised anointed one, was to be designated as the Son of Man. So there's a twofold reason that Jesus uses this term more than any other concerning himself. Because of relatability with us, and because of prophetic implications found in Daniel chapter 7. So he says, who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? And they gave their suggestions that they were hearing around town. Some say John the Baptist, some Elijah, some Jeremiah, or that prophet. But whom do you say that I am? Not the opinions of others, but the conclusions that you're drawing. Who do you say that I am? Perhaps the most important question that has ever been asked any man. Who do you say that I am? Because the hinge of the door to your eternal destiny will turn and pivot on this very question. Who do you say that Jesus is? Who do you say personally? Not who does your husband say, or who does John say, or who does this theologian say. Who do you say? Who is Jesus to you personally? Who do you say that I am? And at that point, Peter answered and said, Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered and said, Blessed art thou, Simon Bar-Jonah, or Simon, son of Jonah. For flesh and blood hath not revealed it unto thee, but my Father which is in heaven. And I say also unto thee that thou art Peter, Petros, small stone. And upon this rock, Petra, as we talked about Sunday, the great confession that he made, this massive statement that he made, you're the Christ. Upon that confession, I will build my church. Maybe you've wondered about this, thinking, wait a minute. This revelation given to Peter. Jesus said, flesh and blood did not reveal it to you, but my Father which is in heaven. And now Jesus makes this great statement, oh, on this revelation I'll build my church. You might think, but didn't other people say that earlier? Didn't in John chapter 1, when Philip went and found Nathanael and said, hey, come on, we found the one. We found Messiah, Jesus of Nazareth. And Philip, evidently a student of scriptures, said, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? In other words, Philip, hearing about Jesus for the first time, seems to have been aware that the prophecies were that Messiah would come from Bethlehem, not from Nazareth. And of course, at that time, the disciples were just beginning to form, being called, didn't know that Jesus was born in Bethlehem and had moved to Nazareth as a young child. So Philip had a good, or pardon me, Nathanael had a good point when he said, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? That's not biblical. Plus, it's a lousy spot. It's an ugly part of the country. Dump. Come and see. That's what Philip said. Hey, Nathanael, just come and see. So Nathanael went with Philip. And they came to Jesus. And Jesus looked at Nathanael coming. And as he here is meeting him for the first time, if you would, said, oh, behold, an Israelite in whom there is no guile. Hey, you're sharp. I like that. He didn't say, you cynic, you skeptic. Nathanael not believing in me, doubting if any good thing can come out of Nazareth. He, oh, you're sharp. Yeah, good. And Nathanael said, how do you know me? And Jesus said, I saw you reading under the fig tree, or when you were under the fig tree, evidently several miles away. Whoa, he says, truly thou art the Son of God, the King of Israel. And Jesus said, you believe because I saw you under the fig tree? Stick around, he said. Now here, Nathanael made this statement, thou art the Son of God, the King of Israel. And yet Jesus didn't say, oh, blessed are you, upon that rock I'll build my church. It didn't count, evidently. Or how about when they were in Luke, taking in a haul of fish, as Jesus told them, hey, cast your nets and take in a haul. And these fish came in. The disciples said, oh, truly thou art the Son of God. And yet Jesus didn't say, oh, blessed are you, upon that rock I'll build my church. Or how about in John 6, the end of the chapter, around 65, verse 65, when 5,000 were fed, and even there, Peter declared at that time, which took place before this event in Matthew 16, he said, oh, truly thou art the Son of God. You alone have the words of eternal life. Jesus didn't say, oh, good for you. Upon that rock I'll build my church. Why? They had spoke these same words at other times, but listen carefully. It's very important you hear me here. Because those were emotional responses in every case based upon some kind of miracle, some kind of event. And they were emotionally saying, wow, heavy. You saw me under the fig tree? You must be the Son of God. Ooh, look at these fish. You must be the Son of God. Or wow, 5,000 are fed. You must be the Son of God. And yet Jesus did not give credence to any of those confessions that were based on an emotional response to a miracle. This is not an emotional response. This is a carefully thought through conclusion in a quiet setting in response to an intellectual question based upon supernatural revelation. Now, why do I say this is important? Because a lot of times people will make a prayer saying, oh, wow, my mom was healed of cancer. I'm going to go to church. And they'll go to church for about 5 months at the most, in many cases. Or, oh, wow, my husband didn't get fired when they were laying off everybody, so we're going to go to church and start, you know. And people respond emotionally because of some kind of material blessing. But that doesn't get it. It's when a man or a woman, after serious, careful observation, comes to a rational, intellectual conclusion based upon deep spiritual revelation and says, you know something? You're the Christ. You are it. Not because I won the lottery. Not because I feel better physically. Not because I didn't get shot when I was in the army. I have concluded that you're the Christ based upon a deep revelation. Jesus now said, this is serious. Blessed are you. Now, we're not talking about an emotional response or a 5-month trip into Christianity. You have made a decision, a declaration, and I'll build my church upon that rock, upon that reality. I don't get really excited when people make a conversion, so to speak, based upon some sort of emotion, some sort of event. What thrills my heart is when a man, a woman, says, you know, I'm concluding that Jesus really is who he declared to be, the Son of God, and I'm giving my life to follow him totally. Upon that rock I'll build my church. Well, if you were here on Sunday, we looked at this passage in light of the church. If you weren't here, could I encourage you to get up, to go back and get the tape when we're done here. It's important as we talk about this passage in relationship to the church that Jesus Christ builds. A very important study, I think, for the Applegate Fellowship. Oh, I'll build my church. The gates of hell shall not prevail against it. And I will give unto thee the keys of the kingdom. Whatsoever thou shalt bind on earth shall be bound, even as it is bound in heaven, literally. Whatsoever thou shalt loose on earth shall be loosed, even as it is in heaven. Again, this binding and loosing is not to get heaven to do our bidding, but we are saying we are in harmony with heaven, even as Jesus taught us to pray. Thy will be done on earth as it is being done in heaven. This would radically affect the way that we pray and what we pursue in faith if we understand that Jesus is not saying, here's some keys, binding and loosing, blessing and forgiveness and discipline. Whatever you want to do, we'll all make it happen in heaven. No, it's just the opposite. You are to be binding and loosing even as it is done in heaven. Be in harmony with me. How do we know what that is? By the word. It is not just a matter of making a statement saying that we bind this or we loose that. That's missing the point. It's not a phrase. It's not a mantra. It's not a cliche. It's an attitude of the heart saying, we want what you're doing and about in heaven to be happening in this situation, based upon the scriptures. Thy will be done on earth even as it is being done in heaven. Then, verse 20, charged he his disciples that they should tell no man that he was Jesus the Christ. From that time forth began Jesus to show unto his disciples how he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things of the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised again the third day. Then Peter took him, began to rebuke him, saying, be it far from thee, Lord, this shall not be unto thee. Interesting. When it came earlier in chapter 16 concerning revelation of Jesus as the Christ, Peter was into it. But now, Peter had reservation seeing Jesus on the cross. No, don't talk this way, Peter says. He had just made this great confession as he saw Jesus, the Christ, the Messiah. But now when he sees Jesus on the cross, as he's talking about this coming event, be it far from thee, no. And Jesus said to Peter, get thee behind me, Satan, for thou art an offense unto me. For thou savorest not the things that be of God, but those that be of man. Moments earlier, Peter had a revelation from the Father. Now, Peter is being used as an instrument of Satan. This tells me a couple of things. First of all, it knocks out Peter as a candidate for popeship. Because if you adopt the idea that Peter was the first pope, as our Catholic friends do, part of being a pope is that in ex cathedra, that is, when you're speaking on spiritual matters, you are infallible. Peter was definitely fallible at this point. In fact, Jesus called him Satan because he was no longer in revelation, in harmony with the Father. Now he's in conjunction with the enemy. Peter was not infallible. Well, some might say, however, this was before Peter was filled with the Holy Spirit. Now, once Jesus had died and resurrected and he was filled with the Spirit, then Peter, as the Pope, if you would, infallible. Read Galatians 2. Galatians 2 says that Paul declares, when I saw Peter, I rebuked him to his face. Why? Because Peter was getting back into the Jewish kosher thing. And he was putting up rules and regulations again, so to speak. And Paul said, I rebuked him. So even after Peter was filled with the Spirit, Peter still blundered. I love Peter, but I do not acknowledge him as being infallible or the first pope, if you would. If you go to St. Peter's Basilica, there that glorious Michelangelo carving of Peter. People are so exalting Peter and into Peter that they have actually kissed his toe away. The toe is no longer on his foot. There's so many kisses on Peter's toe that his toe is no longer there, worn down over hundreds and hundreds of years. If they keep that up, Peter will soon be defeated. But really, here, Peter, now So I do reject this idea, well, now Peter is the Pope and the succession line goes from Peter. But it also encourages me in the fact that people say, well, you know, how can this person on Sunday night speak a word of prophecy when Monday morning I saw him kick the cat or yell at his wife? And people say, how can this person speak with authority one minute and the next minute be so carnal or amiss? Well, Peter was. One minute he had revelation from the Father. Genuine, true revelation acknowledged by Jesus, and the keys of the kingdom were entrusted to him and the church. The next minute, he was in the flesh. That encourages me. Because that means I can listen to people and not say, well, I'm not going to hear what you're saying because 2 weeks ago I saw you lose your temper or you said something dumb, so therefore you're off my list. No, I realize the frailty of humanity, that we all can move into times of revelation and deep understanding and then moments later be off the wall and out to lunch. And it doesn't discount the revelation that Peter spoke earlier. It only proves to us that we're all human. We're all fallible. We're all frail. Without exception. Then Jesus said to his disciples, in talking about the cross that Peter was reacting against, that Peter said, no way, not the cross. Jesus said, if any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. By the way, a phrase that we often use, in fact, somebody not part of this congregation, not part of our church, told me recently, you know, I suffer from hay fever and that's my cross. I knew what she was saying, but that's really not right. The cross doesn't mean if you suffer from hay fever or if you have a foot problem or maybe even a heart murmur or even perhaps cancer. Jesus is not saying, if any man come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross. Those are problems that every person has. It's part of humanity. So if you're going through something hard physically, something hard financially, don't necessarily say that's your cross. The cross means, to take up the cross means that you are saying, I'm identifying with Jesus so much so that this is suffering and shame and rejection and perhaps even death. Not something which I have to put up with. I got to bear my cross, but I am embracing this. People at work may think I'm weird. My family may reject me. The kids might not like me, but I am going to deny myself. I'm going to take up the cross, shame, suffering, rejection, even death possibly, and follow him. That's the cross. Not some hurt, affliction that you might be going through. But rather, it's a purposing in your heart, a determination that no matter what, you're making a stand. It's a choice. If any man come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, follow me. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it. Whosoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it. What is a man profited if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? For the Son of Man shall come in the glory of his Father with his angels. Then he shall reward every man according to his works. Here's the irony. If you give up yourself and take up his cross, you're going to find life. The more you live for yourself and pamper yourself and think about yourself, the more miserable you'll be. You'll lose life entirely. Both now and eternally. But the more you say, Lord, I'm going to live for you completely, wholeheartedly, totally, the more you'll have of life now and eternally. That's a fact that Jesus taught. it would be good for us to meditate, I think, upon that and really say, Lord, what about that? Who am I living for? What are my priorities? What's my agenda? What are my goals? If it's for yourself, you'll be miserable. The more you die to self, the happier you'll be. The more you live for yourself, the more miserable you'll be. That's an absolute radical principle that Jesus taught us. When were you happiest? Really? The happiest times of your life, if you think back and reflect on, you'll say, it was when I was really going for it in Jesus Christ. When that was the priority of my life and the passion in my heart, Jesus Christ. I didn't care what people thought. I didn't care what it cost. I was bearing His cross. The more I live for myself, though, somehow the more unhappy I become. Jesus said, man, it doesn't make sense. You'll lose your life. And eternally, if you don't get in the program and follow Jesus, you can profit by gaining the whole world but losing your soul. What good is that going to be? But the Son of Man shall come, verse 27, and if you're taking up the cross and following Him, you'll be rewarded in the ages to come as well as presently. Verily, I say to you, verse 28, there be some standing here which shall not taste of death till they see the Son of Man coming in His kingdom. Some are standing right here, Jesus said to His 12, that are not going to taste of death till they see the coming of the Son of Man in His kingdom. Wait, you say, I got a problem with that. Did they? Aren't they all dead? Did they see the coming of His kingdom? Did Jesus miss at this point? Well, we'll see next week. The answer to that question and chapter 17, man, you're going to be blessed. 17 is truly a mountaintop experience for the believer. It truly is. The transfiguration. Perhaps for you, the transfiguration has been a real mystery. Why is it so significant? What does it mean practically? We're going to delve into that. And, I thought perhaps we'd get there tonight. We didn't. I was aware of that about 20 minutes ago that we wouldn't. So we just sort of slowed down because I didn't want to rush through 17. It deserves our meditation. Read chapter 17, just 17, and we'll come together next Wednesday night and continue on together. Shall we stand? I challenge you with this tonight. Upon this rock I'll build my church. The phrase was well known to the Jews, for in Deuteronomy 32, over and over again, the Lord is describing Himself to His people as a rock. And if you look it up later on, you'll see it's capitalized. The rock of our salvation. There's this classic little verse there in Deuteronomy 32 that says, for our rock is not as their rock, speaking of the enemies of Israel. Our rock, capital R in the King James Version, is not as their rock, small r. We're on solid ground. We have substance and meaning and solidity. I listen to my kids' Christian rock records. And I go, yeah, our rock is not as their rock. Our rock has meaning. Not suggesting people to live immorally, to blast out their brains, to experiment with dark occult practices. Our rock is not as their rock. Our rock gives hope and understanding and solidity and purpose. Not just true in music, in every area of life. We have the answer, Jesus Christ, the solid rock. The question is that I want to leave you with tonight. Have you determined that? Who do you say that Jesus is? Not based upon what you hear from me or from your family. Who is Jesus to you? Have you made that thoughtful conclusion based upon spiritual illumination? Yes. He is the Christ. Because if you have, you know what that'll mean? You're going to do great. Whether you're going through times of blessing and happiness and victory, or whether you go through times of sickness and setback and tragedy, it won't matter. Because you've made a determination based upon revelation, not upon emotion. Nothing wrong with emotion. A marriage that doesn't have emotion is going to be not what it should be. You need to be in love emotionally. But a marriage cannot be based upon emotion. It won't last very long. When challenges and difficulties and hard times come, so too, in your walk with Jesus Christ, if your whole thing is based upon, ooh, I got a new car, so I'm going to go to church. Don't. You know? You need to make a serious, sober conclusion. Who do you say that Jesus is? And when you conclude, He is the Christ. No matter what, He's the Christ. Upon that rock, He'll build your life. And the gates of hell shall not prevail. And you won't be shaken. You won't be tossed around. But you'll stand solidly whether you're prospering or whether you're plagued. Upon that rock, He'll build your life. May the Lord give you that. May you take time, perhaps even this night, to settle that question. And make sure that you're basing your salvation upon Jesus Christ. In Jesus' name.